This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's president says that the settlement of safeguards issues between Tehran and the UN nuclear agency is one of the conditions to reach a deal on reviving the JCPOA. Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr says he's quitting politics and closing his institutions amid political disagreements over the formation of a new government. And a huge relief operation is underway in Pakistan in the wake of devastating floods. The death toll from the disaster keeps rising. Good everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behram Sanjafi. Good to have you with us. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has stressed his country's demands in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
What have been raised are first, assuring guarantees. Second, the verification of the sanctions removal in an objective and practical manner. Third, the removal of sanctions in a meaningful and sustainable way. And fourth, an end to what I call political accusations regarding safeguard issues.
Raisi says an agreement on the JCPOA revival hinges on the settlement of safeguards issues between Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency. He also called the safeguards allegations against Iran baseless and politically motivated. The IAEA has recently asked Iran to provide explanation for what it calls traces of enriched uranium at some of its undeclared sites. Tehran has urged the agency to abandon such allegations that often come from the Israeli regime. In a presser in Tehran, Raisi also called on the signatories to honor their obligations under the 2015 accord. The pact hit a snag when former U.S. President Donald Trump walked out of it and reimposed sanctions. Tehran and other parties have been in talks to revive the deal for more than a year. Tehran is now reviewing the U.S. response to a recent EU draft proposal aimed at reviving the accord. The political analyst Fashid Balgharian joined us earlier to tell us more about Iran's conditions in the JCPOA revival talks.
The fact is, Not the atomic agency. The fact is the trust and commitment afterward of the signing any agreement. Because we know, after the withdrawal of the Mr. Trump by tearing out the agreement, we cannot trust anymore the United States. Maybe some other part of agreement. So the fact is, right now, Iranian not only the prime, not only the presidency, the rule of Iran. Need commitment and the trust and the guarantee for not issuing any other condition or withdrawing anymore, because you cannot accept any other damages that caused by the new withdrawal. The fact is, right now, they are trying to know more about our activities in this field, because if you see this, Israel is trying to put some impact and more influences on the decision of Mr. Biden right now.
Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr says that he is quitting politics and closing his institutions, a decision that could further heighten tensions amid months of political deadlock in Iraq. Sadr has slammed other leaders for not heeding to his calls for reform. He did not elaborate on the closure of his offices, but said some of his cultural and religious institutions would remain open. The announcement came as Sadr supporters continue their sit-in outside the Supreme Judicial Council in Baghdad to step up pressure on the body to dissolve the parliament. Iraq has been without a government or a head of state for months. Last parliamentary election saw an alliance led by Sadr win most seats, but he failed to form a government. huge relief operations underway in Pakistan in the wake of rain-triggered floods that devastated the whole country last week. The government already declared a national emergency and deployed the army to help with rescue and aid efforts. Army helicopters are struggling to pick people from the mountains north to safety. The National Disaster Management Authority has reported 28 more deaths, pushing the figure to more than 1,060 since June. Last week, historic rains devastated four main provinces, with Balochistan being the hardest hit. The floods have destroyed more than 2 million acres of crops, thousands of kilometers of roads, and dozens of bridges.
Monsoon rains are still pounding Pakistan, hampering all sorts of communications in key cities and towns in four provinces of the country. Roads, houses, hotels, and buildings, along with other infrastructures, have been washed away by the flood waters. Southwestern Balochistan and northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces are now in the spotlight due to the sheer magnitude of devastation witnessed there in recent days. That's while millions of Pakistanis ravaged by extreme flooding are still awaiting relief in remote rural areas. Across large swaths of Pakistan, houses, schools, roads, and bridges have been destroyed. Floods also left thousands displaced and struggling to find safety along with their livestock. Meanwhile, Shehbaz Sharif has visited the heavily affected areas. He has already appealed to the international community to send aid and relief to help them deal with the devastation.
We are doing our best to help flood-affected people. The 30 years record of monsoon has been broken this year. The situation is demanding that we all should rise above the politics and to help the flood victims to overcome their miseries.
Pakistan is 8th on the Global Climate Risk Index for being one of the most vulnerable countries in the face of extreme weather caused by climate change. The country witnessed more rain than ever recorded this monsoon season.
As floods have caused havoc from north to the south, the government has declared national emergency. With 33 million affected by the floods, authorities struggle to rescue people and provide relief. Nasir Kazmi, Nosheera, Northwest Pakistan.
Afghan women rights activists have opened a library in capital Kabul. The initiative aims to promote reading and provide an educational space for women who've been excluded from public life since the Taliban's takeover of the country in August last year. Our correspondent reports from the capital city.
Afghan women have been struggling for their rights under the Taliban rule. Recently, they have launched this cultural spot under the name of Women's Library.
There are more than 2,000 books in this library. Women and girls can borrow books or enjoy reading them here.
Meanwhile, the founders of the library say this place offers plenty more than just books.
Our aim for setting up this library is to provide teenage girls with a place to study, communicate, and receive an education. Our second goal is to provide a cultural spot for those women who have lost their jobs and have nothing to do. You know that today many Afghan women are literate and don't accept forced isolation at their homes.
Mitra Kakar, a student of 11th grade, was banned from attending her school when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in August last year. She visits such places to study books, practice drawing, and hang out with friends.
It has been almost a year since we were left out of school. When the Taliban came to power, we were told not to attend our classes. Since then, I have been going through tough times, but I never quit receiving my education. I got an English class and started learning drawings. I also love books and libraries like this. I just hope our school reopens and I can make it to the university. I want to study fine arts.
This place is also becoming a stage for women to speak out. One of the women rights activists here told us that the Afghan women are facing a rollback on their rights since the Taliban's return to power.
If we look through history, Afghanistan has had many prominent, creative, and leading women in different arenas. But since we live under the Taliban rule, it looks like this chain is unfortunately being broken. With women women being sidelined or disappearing from active social life. We will keep raising our voices and defend our rights. Neither Islam nor Afghan culture has barred women from getting an education or going to work.
Afghan women rights activists also call on the global community to take serious and practical steps for women rights in Afghanistan. They say that merely condemnations can't relieve their pain, but the international community needs to come forward to press the Taliban to change their stance and uphold the rights of women and girls. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Israeli forces kidnapped a young Palestinian man after wounding him during a raid on the occupied West Bank city of Qabatia, south of the city of Jenin. The regime forces encircled the house of Ala Zakarna and forced his family to leave before storming it and rounding him up. At least 10 more people sustained injuries after troops fired live rounds at local youths and resistance fighters protesting the raid. One person who was shot in the back is said to be in critical condition. Zakarna is a member of Al-Quds Brigades, an armed wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. According to media, clashes in different parts of the West Bank in response to the latest Israeli attack have taken place. The International Atomic Energy Agency chief is leading a delegation to Ukraine to inspect the Zaporizhia nuclear plant that's now under the control of Russian forces. Rafael Grossi said that the IAEA support and assistance mission will arrive at Europe's largest nuclear power plant later this week. He also posted a photograph showing him and a team of 13 people on their way to Ukraine. Grossi has for months been asking for permission, warning of a nuclear disaster risk amid reports of repeated shelling of the plant. The Zaporizhia site was taken over by Russian troops shortly after they launched an offensive in Ukraine in late February. Moscow and Kiev have traded blame for shelling around the complex. In a UN Security Council meeting last week, Russia's envoy confirmed an IAEA mission will visit the site. He said that Moscow will extend maximum support possible to resolve all organizational issues. The United States says it's accelerating production of high-mobility rocket systems, or HIMARS, to supply them to Ukraine to help it fight Russia. And that's why Moscow has repeatedly warned that the arming of Ukraine adds fuel to the fire and prolongs the war. We've discussed that issue in our news review program just an hour ago. Let's see what our guests had to say. Now, to get some insight, well, let's invite a couple of guests. Barry Grossman is a political analyst. He's in Bali, Indonesia. Manuel Pasrais, president of Asia Institute in Seoul. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. So, Barry, adding fuel to the fire and prolonging the war, is this the goal that the U.S. is pursuing, as the Kremlin is claiming?
Well, I think it's been clear from the beginning the U.S. has a very big investment in keeping the conflict going in the Ukraine and accelerating the conflict in the Ukraine, all as part of its long-range strategy or tactic of isolating Russia. This is a war which the Ukraine cannot win. It's a bit like the mouse that roared. And while with military aid to the tune of countless billions from Atlantic world countries, it can slow the process of losing this conflict down, it can't win. And of course, the Atlantic world's man in Kiev is completely opposed to any kind of a political resolution, bearing in mind that when the failing Soviet Union, soon to be Russia, agreed to grant independence to the Ukraine, it did so on the basis of the Ukraine signing an agreement committing to being a neutral party. And of course, it's been anything but neutral in recent years, as the U.S. agenda plays out, which first gave us the maiden protests and the civil unrest that followed, and eventually civic unrest throughout the eastern provinces, where they're predominantly populated by ethnic Russians. So this particular president of Ukraine, apart from being corrupt, is very committed to pushing the U.S. agenda, which is to keep this conflict alive, this military conflict, at the expense of Ukrainians. I don't think short-range missiles are going to make a great deal of difference in terms of the eventual outcome of this war, even a great deal of tactical difference in the short term. Because whatever the Ukraine can do with U.S., British, and wider Atlantic world help, the Russians are more than capable of doing with their own armory.
Now, Emmanuel, U.S. Has so far, as I just mentioned, contributed $14 billion, okay, worth of military armament to Kiev, and now they looks like that they're adamant to keep doing that. Okay, we see Lockheed Martin and other arms, you know, people are in the arms business. They are making big bucks. No, right. The U.S. is benefiting from this, and especially arms manufacturers. What about European countries? Are they not losing? Look at the energy prices. Cost of living in the UK and others.
Well, obviously, for the average person in Europe, or for that matter, in the Ukraine, things are quite severe in terms of the impact, not just in energy, but in food prices. Ukraine itself is a major food producer, and in some ways, all these multinational corporations. We're most interested, actually, in the food production in Ukraine. And the situation is not getting better. Europe is reaching a state it hasn't seen, really, in some ways, since the 1950s. And that's a global impact. In the Ukraine specifically, the impact has been devastating. And there, as you noted, there's no end in sight. And for all we can see, Lockheed Martin is gung-ho about increasing conflict, selling more weapons, and trying to engage Russia in what could potentially be a world war or a nuclear war.
Okay, thank you so much for your comments. Bera Grossman in Indonesia and Emmanuel Pasraj in Seoul. Welcome back. Moving on, Japan has launched joint war games with the United States on the country's southwestern island of Kyushu. Some 1,400 Japanese ground forces and 700 U.S. Army personnel are participating in the exercises that began on Sunday. The maneuvers include live firings of the Javelin anti-tank missile, a portable weapon that the U.S. has supplied to Ukraine. Tokyo says that the exercises are aimed at improving response capability to defend Japan's remote islands. The joint exercises come against the backdrop of rising tensions with China over a host of issues, including the South China dispute and tensions over Taiwan. Meanwhile, two U.S. Navy warships have sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite warnings from China. And this is the first such transit since China staged unprecedented military drills around the island over a growing diplomatic and military nexus between Taiwan and the U.S. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on July 27, 2022.
The people's presence is the foundation. When we recite words remembering Allah in a group, the effects and blessings of it descend upon the group. In the Quran, it is stated that, "For admonition indeed benefits the faithful." The Quran, Surah 51, verse 55. Everyone benefits from it. Yes, even when you pray the night prayer in solitude in your room, the Almighty Allah will still bestow its benefits on you. But here, during the Friday prayer, this benefit is a public benefit. Everyone benefits from it. Or consider the verse, "Remember me and I will remember you." The Quran, Surah 2, verse 152. "I will remember you." This special grace from God is a result of dhikr. Dhikr here is remembering God in a group. So the grace that is granted is for the whole group. Or, "And remember Allah greatly so that you may be felicitous." The Quran, Surah 8, verse 45. And many of the verses that are in the Quran. I referred to Al-Mu'jam Al-Mufahras, Quranic Index. And these few verses came to mind for now, which I've written down. If you search, there are plenty of verses that talk about the blessings that dhikr brings. This is one feature, the collective remembrance of Allah and its blessings.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The next feature is the continuity of this event, these weekly meetings. Well, the Hajj pilgrimage is once in a person's lifetime. That's how it usually is. But this Friday prayer is a weekly event. This is very important. As far as I am aware, and I've done some research on this, there is no other spiritual gathering in any religion, in any place, where the people of a city or a large group of people in a city gather in a central place together on a weekly basis. What the content of this gathering should be constitutes the next issue. This is a very important feature. This is where the excellence of this gathering becomes evident, even in comparison to Hajj. It takes place one week after another. This week, next week, the week after that, and so on. Well, this is an example of what we read in Dua Kumail, "So that my works and litanies may all be a single litany, and my occupation with your service everlasting." It's continuous. It's not a matter of being there one day and absent the next, or being present in one place but not being present somewhere else. I need to be continually at your service, and my occupation with your service everlasting. This is how this weekly gathering is. This is how my occupation with your service everlasting can be carried out.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It has been a rocky economic road that the Brits are traveling on, which continues to chip away at their income. Some were questioning how they would manage their expenses in the UK these days. Why, with an unprecedented inflation and a cost of living crisis, now their nightmare has gotten worse. An 80% increase in electric and gas bills have been announced, one that is coming before the winter season.
It is a major problem because what is happening, of course, is, first of all, real incomes are falling because people are not getting wage settlements in line with inflation, but below inflation. Then tax burden has increased, you know, to record levels as well. The government has been raising taxes to pay for the furlough scheme and all the money that they splurged.
To be exact, an 80% increase would mean that it would average about £3,600, or about $4,200 per year from October. And this is terrible news, especially for the poor and the ones at the bottom half of the social strata. The UK was suffering already from high energy prices, in particular heating bills, even before the Ukraine crisis began. So bad was the situation that fuel poverty, as it was called, was leading to deaths for people who could not afford to heat their homes. These are the stats that are truly shocking, that one would not expect from a European country. For example, this article in 2020 pointed out to how thousands of people in the UK died from the cold, and that fuel poverty was to blame. On average, there were 32,000 more deaths between December and March than the rest of the year. Many perished because of the refusal of a society with abundant wealth and resources to provide for its most vulnerable citizens. An average of 9,700 deaths each year were believed to be caused by living in a cold house.
We know we need to do more because actually the most vulnerable households have no cushion, have nothing available to them. So what I'm looking at is how I can target that help for those people, not just to January.
The unprecedented hike for energy prices in the UK will surely affect the UK's economy. One obvious outcome of this price increase is that it will chip away at people's spending power and income. This is while people's income has not kept pace with the inflation rate. Increases have been minimal or not at all. This may explain why there have been so many strikes and protests recently in different sectors in the UK. The latest, the postal worker strike. 115,000 workers across 1,500 locations. Criminal barristers and mass rail strikes have also plagued the UK, as the country is battling a historic cost of living crisis. The outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson has sure left an economic mess for the next administration to deal with. But was it all his fault? The UK did not have a sound economy even before the pandemic started. Among the group of G7 economies, the UK has suffered the highest inflation rate than any other G7 country, as price rises have reached a 40-year record, with inflation recorded at 10.1% in the year for the month of July. That is the highest since the year 1982. And with the Ukraine crisis showing no signs of ending, the future looks bleak for the country, especially since the new administration will not officially begin work until October. And Boris Johnson's view on this, the new administration will clearly have to help people with energy bills.
That I know that even if things can sometimes seem dark now.
The army of the Islamic Republic of Iran has staged a massive drill which features scores of cutting-edge reconnaissance and combat drone. The drill covers the strategic waters of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, as well as the country's central regions. Over 150 new advanced drones are flown in the drill. The Army's 1401 joint drone exercise involves units from the Ground Force, Navy, Air Force and Air Defense Force. The units have already carried out their intelligence gathering and patrol missions. They include homegrown Yasir, Sadr, Yazdan and Ababil 3 tactical surveillance unmanned aerial vehicles, Pelican vertical takeoff and landing naval drone, as well as Muhajir 6 were also flown from different bases. Muhajir 6 is an ISTAR drone, which means the drone can operate intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition and reconnaissance missions. it can significantly boost Iran's capability in confronting threats. The drill features the Army's latest achievements in drone engineering and production. Due to the expansion of unmanned aerial capabilities, execution of various and numerous drone missions, and the need to coordinate such flights, the Army has set up a command and control network for the drone operations. The exercise exhibits only a small fraction of the achievements made by the Islamic Republic of Iran's army.
Iran has for some time now shown that it is a world leader in drone technology, both in terms of indigenous capabilities developed by Iranian industries and the reverse engineering that Iran has done off of some of the United States frontline drones, which Iran has acquired one way or another. But it's not just the technology, it's how it's adapted for the modern battlefield.
This is the first time that a joint drone exercise is conducted at the level of the four forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army and the country's joint air defense base. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headways in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient in the armed sphere.
And so it's drones and the technology and the tactics are adapted to these realities. And so, it's one thing, though, to have theoretical knowledge. It's another to have practical. And these exercises, I think, take Iran's drones and allows the Iranian military to practice using these drones in realistic scenarios that will make these drones more effective if Iran is ever called upon to use them in a conflict.
Iran says it has become an exporter of military drones in the world and that the country holds the upper hand in aerospace. Back in July, when U.S. President Joe Biden was visiting the West Asia region, Iran's army unveiled its first division of ships and submarines capable of carrying armed drones.
It's the height of hypocrisy, hubris-based hypocrisy, for the United States, Israel, or any Western nation that incorporates drone technology into their operations to call out Iran for developing their own drone capability and employing these drones in support of Iranian backed actions in the region. The United States invented the armed drone, and the United States has used armed drones extensively throughout its involvement in the Middle East and Central Asia and elsewhere.
Earlier this year, Iran's new combat drone called Gaza successfully passed flight tests and became fully operational. The vehicle has a 21-meter wingspan and a 3,100-kilogram takeoff mass with the capability of carrying a payload of 500 kilograms. And before that, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unveiled one of its new kamikaze drones, dubbed Mirage 504, which is specialized in attacking enemies' defense systems. The Islamic Republic's military doctrine holds that the country's armed capability solely serves defensive purposes and poses no threat to other states.
The United States is increasing its belligerence in Syria by launching airstrikes on the country. On Tuesday, the U.S. has carried out airstrikes on a camp in Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria, claiming the area and the infrastructure there were used by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Iran rejected the allegation as baseless, saying they were a breach of Syria's sovereignty.
And you know, I'm not sure what's going on here, whether they were attacking them because they were afraid that they might be preparing to launch some kind of offensive against American troops in Iraq, or whether they were doing it just to please Israel and to make Israel say, you know, look, even if we go back to the JCPOA, we're still going to be aggressive against Iran.
The U.S. claimed that the attack was in response to a mid-August drone strike on one of its bases in Syria. On Wednesday, the U.S. then launched more strikes in Deir ez-Zor, which were retaliated by rocket attacks against U.S. bases. Several U.S. servicemen were said to be injured in those rocket attacks. The U.S. military's Central Command, which oversees the American forces in the West Asia region, said in a statement that the aerial assault had been aimed at, quote, protecting U.S. forces from attacks. Deir ez-Zor is a strategic province in East Syria. It borders Iraq and contains vast oil fields. The U.S. forces entered that region in 2015 without the consent of the Syrian government.
The United States is occupying Syrian territory illegally and criminally, and the Syrian government has the right to have what host whatever it forces it wants on its territory. And the United States forces are going to be attacked. I don't know who's going to attack them or whether they'll be attacked, but certainly the Syrian government has the right to attack them and get them out of their country. But the United States doesn't feel it needs to provide proof to people. It presumes that when it says something, people will accept it because they have to.
Washington claimed that it wanted to prevent the oil fields from falling into the hands of terrorists, but it has now turned out that the occupying U.S. forces are plundering the country's rich resources. Just recently, Syrian news agency reported that U.S. military has smuggled crude oil from Syria to bases in Iraq. It was reported that a convoy of 122 tankers laden with oil from the energy-rich Jazeera region in Syria's northern eastern province of Haska moved through the illegal Mahmoudiya border crossing into neighboring Iraq.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them, they've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home. But we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil, and we're working with the Kurds, and we're frankly working with Turkey, and we're working with a lot of countries.
The U.S. is also running Al-Tanf military base in the Syrian province of Homs. The military base lies close to an intersection between the borders of Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, and has therefore a strategic importance. It is also the only U.S. military base not located in the areas held by Kurdish militants in the Arab country. It's believed that U.S. is using the base to train and support Daesh terrorists to use them for its own benefits.
They're occupying Syrian territories, they're stealing their oil, they're occupying the most productive agricultural territory, you know, and they have absolutely no right to do this. And they're doing it, and they've said they're doing it, in order to prevent the reconstruction of Syria, in order to keep Syria down economically and socially, and really in order to keep Syria weak and to keep alive the political project of replacing the Syrian government, replacing the Syrian regime, and breaking up the Syrian state, which they've had to put on hold, but they haven't given up.
Like waging attacks against the Syrian army or its allies. The U.S. has aligned itself with Kurdish forces in northern Syria, who took up arms against the Syrian government when the crisis started in the Arab country. But Syria's northern neighbor, Turkey, is not happy with the presence of Kurdish forces on its borders, whom Ankara views as terrorists. Turkey, which is a strong supporter of anti-Syria forces, is now considering a military action in northern Syria. That incursion would further complicate the situation in an already complex environment.
Daria Dugin, a journalist and prominent media personality sanctioned by the US and the UK, was massively pro-war, that she even wrote a book about it. But was she the target, or was her father? The two had been at a cultural festival together that afternoon. Alexander Dugin had given a lecture. Similar to many of his lectures, this one was no exception, and was fully in line with his views. While many believe Dugin dreamt of a new Russian Empire, others said they heard echoes of these ideas during some of Russian president's speeches, including the one about Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. Saturday's incident was first witnessed by the world through unverified video footage showing Dugin at the scene of his daughter's death. Soon after, Russian Federal Security Service said the car bombing was orchestrated and carried out by Ukrainian secret services. Kiev has, on the other hand, denied the claim, saying it had nothing to do with the incident. But whether Ukraine was behind the attack or not, Russia is bound to respond to the true perpetrators of the attack, and the question remains, what kind of response can the world expect from Moscow?
Well, Russia's responses have been fairly targeted so far. They have a type of Iraq invasion in their military operations, but I believe that they will, based on their history of the last 6 months, probably respond by attacking some of the intelligence and military centers in Ukraine, perhaps in Kiev.
Saturday's bombing has left not only Russia but the world with many unanswered questions. The target is said to have been Dugin, known for his fiery rhetoric and hawkish anti-Western stance. Western media has painted him as a driving force behind key aspects of President Vladimir Putin's foreign policy. However, despite his reputation in the West, in Russia he has never enjoyed official endorsement from the Kremlin and is largely considered a marginal figure. Earlier on Saturday evening, Dugin was giving a lecture at a family festival on the outskirts of Moscow. Unconfirmed reports say Dugin initially planned to leave the festival with his daughter, who was also attending the event, but later decided to take a separate car while Daria took his car. But the question as to why he or his daughter was targeted using such drastic measures remains.
Well, Alexander Dugin is a philosopher who is also a Russian nationalist, and he has some internationalist views which coincide with many of Russia's allies these days. But his daughter also, Daria, let's not forget, was a journalist, a reporter with her own voice. She'd been in liberated Mariupol, for example. So it's not clear exactly, for example, whether Alexander was being targeted or Daria in her own right was being targeted, because apparently her car was targeted and that was not one that her father used. So it's a little difficult to say exactly what the motivation was, but they're clearly, from the gloating, from the glee, from US official sources, including Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, for example, and from many of the extremist Ukrainians, it's clear that they were very happy with this young woman being murdered by a terrorist bombing in Moscow.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Imam Khomeini's statements at the gathering of the Ulama of West of Tehran, October 22, 1969. Up to this moment that we are gathered here, Islam has been maintained by the grace of the Master of Martyrs, Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him. The Master of Martyrs gave his all for Islam in the path of Allah. He had no worldly things to give, but he offered himself, his young ones, and his disciples. He rose in support of Islam to oppose tyranny. He imposed the empire of these days, which were more vehement than mother imperial regimes. He rose up against the tyrant of his day with very few fellow warriors. And though he and his men were all martyred, he was victorious in overthrowing that missionary of cruelty and oppression.
A'udhu billah min ash-shaytanir rajim. We seek refuge from Satan the accursed, and in the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, we start another episode of the program, The Spring of Truth. Welcome to this program in which we try to reflect and contemplate and shed some light and paraphrase some of the sayings and valuable words of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, who is the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. In one of his sayings, he says, essentially, culture forms the identity and existence of a society. With a pervert culture, no matter how powerful a community may be, economically, politically, industrially, and militarily, that community is vain, empty, and hollow. Well, as we said in our previous program, culture is what the people believe in. Culture is what, you know, the values people hold valuable in their lives. And these days, the prevalent culture of people is materialism and consumerism. You know, paying your attention on the carnal aspect of life has turned to everything that matters in life. To eat well, dress well, look perfect is something that people are focusing most of their energy and time on.
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله
صلى الله عليه
صل يا
Living on the surface of life has become very popular. What do I mean by the surface of life? I mean, only the superficial aspect of life is what matters to many people. Their inner richness and personal qualities have secondary importance. And that is why there is so much depression and anxiety in the lives of people. People have everything in life materially, but they're not happy. They have little inner peace. So with this kind of society where there is a poor culture and spirituality doesn't matter much, there is this kind of emptiness in the lives of people. Hope that these contemplations were fruitful to you. Don't forget to join us for our next episode of the program Spring of Truth. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the controversy sparked by the release of 11 Hindu men in India who were jailed for gang-raping a Muslim woman and murdering her family. And we shall also discuss how the Chabahar port as the regional transit hub has emerged as a key area of economic cooperation between Iran and India.
20 years after the gruesome incident and 14 years after the court verdict, 11 Hindu men accused of gang-raping a Muslim woman during anti-Muslim riots in the western Indian state of Gujarat were set free just recently, sending ripples of anger and outrage across the country. The controversial decision to release the convicts was announced by the Hindu nationalist government in Gujarat on the day India was marking its 75th anniversary of independence, and hours after Prime Minister Narendra Modi waxed eloquent about women's empowerment.
Bilkis Bano was 5 months pregnant when she was attacked by a sword-wielding Hindu mob in the small village of Chaparwad in the western Indian state of Gujarat in 2002. Aged 21 at the time, she was gang-raped, while 14 members of her family were murdered, including her 3-year-old daughter. Bilkis Bano was the only witness of the horror. She survived the massacre and led a valiant fight for justice for years. In 2008, a court in Mumbai sentenced 11 Hindu men to life imprisonment on the charge of Bilkis Banu's gang rape and murder of her family members, including her little daughter and a day-old infant. Their conviction was later upheld by the Mumbai High Court. This week on India's Independence Day, all the convicts were released from prison on remission by the Gujarat government, sparking massive outrage. The men were given heroic reception and honored with garlands and sweets by members of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. Opposition parties and human rights groups have strongly denounced the decision to free them. In a statement, more than 6,000 activists described it as a grave miscarriage of justice. In a statement through her lawyer, Bilkis Banu said the news had left her numb and bereft.
The release of the 11 men in the Bilkis Banu case represents a major setback for survivors of the 2002 Gujarat pogrom, who have for years fought for justice despite heavy odds. It has also brought back harrowing memories of the horror unleashed on Muslims in Gujarat. While Hindu-Muslim riots are not uncommon in the so-called world's largest democracy, the anti-Muslim pogrom of 2002 in the state of Gujarat came as a major embarrassment to the country that prides itself on practicing secularism and pluralism.
Gujarat riots, often dubbed as Independent India's first full-blown pogrom, erupted in February 2002 after a mysterious train fire that resulted in the death of 58 Hindu pilgrims was blamed on Muslims. According to various estimates, more than 1,000 Muslims were killed in the ensuing riots as angry Hindu mobs went on a rampage across cities, towns, and villages in the state, raping, killing, and looting Muslims. Prime Minister Modi, who was then Gujarat Chief Minister, was criticized for not doing enough to prevent the massacre of Muslims. He has till late refused to apologize for the massacre or even take moral responsibility for it. Over the years, courts have convicted many people for direct or indirect involvement in the riots, but the high and mighty were all given clean chits, including a close Modi aide and former Gujarat minister Maya Kudnani, who was called the kingpin of the riots by a trial court. The attack on Bilkis Bano and her family was one of the most horrific crimes committed by Hindu mobs during the riots. She had fled from her native village when the violence erupted but could not escape the horror. Her fight continues.
Question of how the society is placed today. It's not about just the death penalty or what crime or what punishment you want to give to this crime. It's about how relationships between men and women and the entire gender spectrum is placed.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Hiba Ahmed, research scholar and assistant professor at the University of Delhi. Welcome to the program, Mrs. Ahmed. Now, 11 Hindu men convicted 14 years ago for gang raping a Muslim woman and murdering her family members were freed from prison in India just recently. Now, do you think this constitutes a travesty of justice?
It's absolutely a travesty of justice. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But when we think about justice and when we think about law, we also need to think for whom the law is being made in a country. And right now, the law is absolutely unequal for the minorities and for the majority. We have to look at what happened when the case, you know, reached the court. At the same time, another rape had happened in the capital of India, which is Delhi, and it was Nirbhaya, which garnered a lot of attention from all over the world, from all over India. And like two judgments were passed simultaneously. One was Nirbhaya and the other was Bilkis Bano's case. And the two judgments were completely different. It shows us what warrants a specific kind of attention in this country at this time. While Bilkis Bano's rapist was sentenced to life imprisonment, Nirbhaya's rapists were sentenced to death because that is what the country was demanding. This is another interesting thing in India where law takes its course depending on what the people of the country are demanding at a particular time. And I'm not saying here whether, you know, a death sentence is better or a life imprisonment is better, but just the fact that people were outraged when Nirbhaya was raped and people did not care with what happened with Bilkis Bano. In fact, the courts termed Bilkis Bano's case as an act of revenge, while Nirbhaya's rape was called the rarest of the rare crime, and therefore the vilest punishment was meted out to the criminals. So this massive difference in judgments by the court of law tells us that law is definitely not equal. And if the law is not equal, then there will be travesties of justice like one after the other.
Mrs. Ahmed, the men were garlanded and offered sweets by the members of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party in Gujarat upon their release. Now, could we say that this could set a dangerous precedent?
I think a dangerous precedent was set when Modi was elected as the Prime Minister of India, because he was the one who incited the entire violence that happened in 2002 in Gujarat. He paraded the bodies of the Hindus who died at the Sabarmati train burning, and then he encouraged self-respecting Hindus to avenge those deaths. And therefore, when these people are released, it only shows that Modi is doing what he promised. He promised that he's going to right the wrongs